Good morning. At the Beat Inn, we handle a myriad of different cases. We handle contract disputes related to partnerships, joint ventures, employment, brokerage agreements, cases related to inheritance, custody, divorce settlements, landlord and tenant issues, intellectual property, and so much more. In the next half hour or so, I'll address some of the procedural issues that arise during the Beat Inn process and are common to all of these different types of cases. I hope to be able to give you a window into our case files at the Beat Inn of America and hopefully provide some practical pointers for Beat Inn practice. I just want to briefly review how a case arrives at Beat Inn. We're at the Beat Inn. The most infrequent way is when parties actually agree and they reach out for intervention. It could be the members of a family-owned business, a couple seeking to arbitrate a divorce settlement, an employer and employee having a dispute. The second way a case may end up in Beat Inn, that's what we see here, is when there's an actual arbitration clause in the contract underlying the dispute. We have here a sample of an arbitration provision that you can find on our website where you can choose to enter these one or two paragraphs into your contract. And this is really what we would recommend to attorneys, and we would especially also recommend to be specific which Beat Inn the parties want to go to avoid the possibility of a stalemate on the choice of Beat Inn in the future. In a case like this where you would have an existing arbitration provision in the contract underlying a dispute, if another party would still refuse to go to Beat Inn, you would be able to go straight to court to compel arbitration. The most common way a case ends up in Beit Din is through the Hazmana process, which Rabbi Shlomo Weissman already briefly mentioned. Our Hazmana, or what we call our New Din Torah application, is available online on our website. A plaintiff would submit the application with a claim letter and supporting documents. Our office would then review the claim with a summary judgment standard of review. And as long as the claim is colorable, the Beit Din of America would send a Hazmana. Upon reviewing an application, most of the recurring issues that we do encounter in the Beit Inn don't really occur during the actual Din Torah hearing. Really, at the hearing at the Din Torah, the Dayanim are in control of the parties, and we hope are also in control of the attorneys. Most of the procedural issues that we do encounter precede the signing of the arbitration agreement. That's really when the trickier issues arise. Upon reviewing an application and a claim, this is a list of the common issues we encounter and we consider when reviewing the claim. So we're going to go through this list very briefly. Cases inappropriate for Beit Din. Cases already litigated in court cannot be reopened or relitigated in the Beit Din. This is very clearly stated in the Ramah on my source sheets on page 17 in the booklet. And as Rabbi Willig already reviewed and presented earlier, the Ramah here says that Misha halach barakos shalakum v'nischaya v'dinehem v'achar kaf chozer v'tavau v'nei dayanei Yisrael yesh omim she'ein nizkakin lo. If somebody already went to court and received an adverse judgment and then tries to then go to Beit Din, some say that we don't attend to this. And in fact, the Beit Din of America would not send a Hazmana in this instance. We often do... The same rule applies also if a case is currently being litigated in court. It can't then simultaneously be also handled in Beit Din. We often receive applications from the defendant in court, and as long as there have been no substantive handling, which Rabbi Willig also mentioned earlier, it obviously becomes a fact-specific discussion, what is substantive, we would send a Hazmana and potentially issue a Seirav if the plaintiff in court refused to transfer the case to Beit Din. If it's the plaintiff in court after already filing in court, then approaches the Beit Din, we would send hazmanas to the defendant requesting him to transfer the matter to Beit Din, but we would not issue a sirah if he would decline. Just to give you an example from our case files, we currently have a case in Beit Din where there's a dispute over attorney's fees. The attorneys are the ones who want to transfer the case to the Beit Din, but the other side refuses. And it's not clear, we're still not sure, we haven't made a conclusive decision whether we would issue a seirah in this case against them for not wanting to transfer to Beit Din, because the matter has been in the court for years, and it's not clear exactly what transpired in court until now. An interesting question is whether filing with an administrative agency, a governmental administrative agency, is equivalent to going to court. Does that fall under the Isser Arkaos? According to the EEOC website, which you have here in the first box on my source sheets, there's a prerequisite to filing a discrimination lawsuit, and that is that you have to first file a charge with the EEOC. So really, the practical point on this matter for attorneys is that you just call us beforehand, right? Make us aware of what's going on should you have a case that falls under something like this. We did have a case where the plaintiff first filed in the EEOC, and the EEOC investigated it and made a finding of no discrimination, and only after that did the plaintiff come to Beit Din. In this instance, the Beit Din of America didn't issue a seirah, but had the plaintiff first or concurrently been in touch with us, maybe there would have been a different outcome. Next on our list, we have Chov Baror, an undisputed claim to a debt owed, like a promissory note, or a mortgage, or a guarantee. These types of debts are viewed by the Beit Din as merely a collection action. The Maharsham makes it clear that in this instance, there are no substantive issues to be adjudicated, and therefore you would not need the Beit Din's permission to go to court. He does add, if you look at our source sheets, that it is considered a midas hachasidus to go to Beit Din. So it's considered a supererogatory, but not at all required. Here you see on our screen, I just wanted to include an article that we have that appears, it's also accessible on our website, in the Journal of the Beit Din of America, an article written by Rabbi Yaakov Feit. It appears also as a supplement to your packet, where he discusses a few instances, exceptions to the Isser of going to court, one of which is the Chov Baror. What may seem like a Chov Baror to one party is not necessarily considered so by another party. Tuition contracts may fall under this heading. Many of the yeshiva day schools in the area name the Beit Din of America in their tuition contracts. And the contracts may say something like there's no refund beyond a certain date. If your child attends a school and then you pull him out, you may not be able to get a refund if it was beyond a certain date. To the school, that may seem like a chov baror. It's clear. They owe us the money. But it's not viewed necessarily by the parent who's arguing that they signed the tuition contract expecting their child to learn, and because there hasn't been a permanent teacher for 6 months and there's been a different one every week, the child hasn't learned anything. This is a good time to mention that the policy of the Beit Din of America is not to give ex parte halachic opinions in any of these matters. People call us up all the time and they want us to be a psak hotline. But the Beit Din will not give anybody over the phone or even, you know, you just call up and ask for a written psak that we're giving you permission to go to court. If somebody calls with a case like this, I would refer them to Rabbi Yaakov Feit's article, and I would also advise them to confer, obviously, with their local Orthodox rabbi. Sometimes it's clear from the beginning that the debt is a chov baror when the party submits their claim. Other times it's not evident until the defendant responds to harazmana and makes it clear that they know they owe the money. And oftentimes the conversation will go something like, I really know I owe him the money, but I just have no money to pay him back. In cases like this, it's my job to negotiate between the parties and come up with some sort of payment plan that's comfortable for both sides. We typically are able, we're typically successful in getting the debtor to sign a statement of debt or a confession of debt, a document where we include a payment schedule and that also usually includes an acceleration clause, which would make the full sum payable should a payment be missed or late. If the debtor refuses to sign some sort of statement of debt and also refuses to come to Beit Din to adjudicate whether he owes the money or not, the Beit Din would then continue the hazmana process, which potentially could result in a seirah being issued against the debtor. Back to our list. We do get some broken engagement cases. Unfortunately, broken engagements happen a lot, and people, especially parents, not necessarily the engaged couple themselves, want to litigate them a lot. You used to be able to sue for breach of promise to marry in New York State and in other states. Since then, though, New York State, like most other states, have passed heart bomb statutes, or sometimes they're referred to as anti-heart bomb statutes, which abolish any cause of action stemming from a breach of contract to marry. If you look on your sheets, I included some of those heart bomb statutes. Obviously, the basis for the heart bomb statutes was to prevent parties from being coerced into marriage, merely to avoid the financial loss associated with a breach of contract to marry. There's no equivalent to the heart bomb statutes in Jewish law. And obviously, we don't want reluctant parties to get married. We encourage at the Beit Din the parties to come to a pshara, some sort of compromise, and politely settle instead of adjudicating in a full arbitration. We are obviously available to help mediate in these matters as well. We also encourage the parties to stop to sign a shtar mechila, which we have an example of here, just a document where the parties are basically exchanging sentiments of forgiveness. It's a very basic document. We had a case when I first came to Beit Din about 2 years ago where the mother of the Kala was a corporate attorney. And before having her daughter return the ring to the chassan, she insisted that both sets of parents and the formally engaged couple all sign a general release where they formally waived any further claims against each other. She wasn't so concerned with the shtar mechila, but she really wanted the general release. And we were able to get the chassan's parents to agree to sign it, even though they were a little weary of it. So we got the parties to sign the shtar mechila and the general release. And actually, one of the most stressful tasks for me at the Beit Din so far has been when the ring was put in escrow at the Beit Din, until the release papers were signed. So there was like a day or two where we had the ring. Okay. Claims involving entities that have discretionary power. We also get a significant amount of phone calls about these kind of cases. We take the view that schools and agencies have discretion to implement policies as they see fit. The Beit Din of America would be willing to mediate or even issue a psak where called upon by both parties, but we wouldn't mandate that a party have to come to Beit Din to arbitrate an issue such as these. I have a few interesting examples that have come up in this category. First, I had a parent call in severe distress. His child was part of a school prank, and the school opted to make an example of the student. It was a dangerous prank, and the parent admitted that. But while there were other students involved, it ended up being that for some reason his son was going to bear the brunt of the consequences. And the parents were concerned that the extreme nature of the consequences were not only going to teach his son hopefully an important lesson, they were also going to really affect his future. and they really wanted the Beitin to summon this yeshiva day school. Really, I wanted to help him so badly, but there really was nothing for us to do. In the end, we did send what we call a soft hazmana to the school, and you can see in a soft hazmana, which has language that's a little different from our standard hazmana, here we basically offer dispute resolution services, and we're prepared to convene a mediation or arbitration to resolve a matter if that is the wish of both parties. So obviously it's soft. We're inviting them to take advantage of the Beit Din if they should so desire, but they have no obligation. And the Yeshiva Day School in this instance was very responsible, called me as soon as they got the hazmana and asked what their obligation was under the hazmana. But they really had no obligation, and obviously they didn't in this instance take advantage of the Beit Din. We had another recent question. Somebody called and he was very hurt. Over the last 10 years, he had davened for the Amid on his father's yahrzeit, and this year there was a new rabbi in the shul, and the rabbi informed him that he was no longer allowed to daven for the Amid on his father's yahrzeit because he wasn't fully Shomer Shabbos. Unfortunately, even though the Beit Din wasn't issuing any sort of halachic judgment as to whether that rabbi was correct in his policy, the Beit Din couldn't get involved in what this rabbi decided was right for his shul. Another case, an out-of-state restaurant owner who was under the supervision of a hashgacha agency and called when the agency threatened to remove their hashgacha because on his credit card bill there were charges from non-kosher suppliers. And he argued that he lent his credit card to his Muslim friends who also owns a different restaurant and he needed to buy these supplies, but that he, of course, had no non-kosher food in his restaurant, in his store. Again, the Beit Din can't get involved in the Hashgacha agency's policy. If you want their Hashgacha, you have to follow what they want you to follow. We do also see a lot of requests for temporary injunctive relief, or equal, as we say in Hebrew, is sought. If you look at the Igros Moshe number 5 in the sources, I don't have so much time, so I'm not going to read it inside, but from the Igros Moshe, the implication is that one may not refuse to appear in Beis Din on the grounds that his adversary already filed for an injunction in secular court. So in a case of imminent monetary loss, one is permitted to file for a preliminary injunction to freeze assets so the substantive case may be adjudicated in the Beit Din. We get calls all the time to issue a restraining order, but we will not issue an ex parte restraining order when we're named in an arbitration clause, like we saw in the beginning of the slides. We will assemble a panel very quickly, but generally still wouldn't issue an ex parte equal. The Beit Din sees itself as a neutral party, and both sides have to be present. While no permission is required, litigants should, and this is again a practice point, should make it clear that their intent is to have the substantive case or the underlying dispute handled by the Beit Din, even if they're going to file in court for a preliminary injunction. Cases where the statute of limitations has run. The presumption at the Beit Din of America is not to issue a seiruv if the statute of limitations has passed. And our general policy is to issue seiruvin when there is a clear disparity between the sides, where one side is legitimately agreeing to come to Beit Din and one party is not. In a case where the statute of limitations has run, that disparity does not exist. It's likely that the plaintiff is coming to the Beit Din because they can't go to court. We got a lot of cases like this. Typically, it's instances where friends lend friends money, or friends invest with friends, or maybe in more Hamish business arrangements, where the parties continue doing business together but money is owed. We had a case where a Jewish company provided services to a Jewish organization for over 10 years, and the bill just kept on adding up without payment from the organization. And then it sat, and then $100,000 was never paid. In a case like this, we can't issue a seiruv against the client for not paying. 10 years have passed. The statute of limitations has run. The practice point here is please be aware of statute of limitations. There could be instances where if the statute, if somehow the facts of the case make it questionable whether the statute was told or not, then we could maybe issue hasmanas and potentially issue a seiruv. Obviously, that's case and fact specific. Okay. Lastly, in this category, I just wanted to mention, especially in light of the new New York Child Victims Act that was passed, is that at the Beit Din of America, we currently have a very firm policy of not accepting cases where there is any implication of criminal liability. We advise people to call the authorities. Okay, once we reviewed claims to make sure that I'm just going to interrupt myself to mention the code word for those who are seeking CLE credit. The code word for this lecture is avocado. Once we have reviewed a claim and made sure that the type of claim is appropriate for Beit Din, we also have to determine whether we have the appropriate parties. Typically, there's an assumption that insurance companies will not adjudicate in Beit Din. And because of this, tort claims end up in secular courts instead of in Beit Din. I did present for you on page 10 of my sources a tshuva by Harav Yitzhak Zilberstein, having to do with a malpractice claim against an OBGYN. The pertinent part, it's an interesting case, but the pertinent part for us is that he says at the end of his tshuva that there's no isser or cause because, and this is even a case that happened in Israel, because there's a non-Jewish insurance company and there's a presumption that a non-Jewish insurance company will not come to court. I also just wanted to quickly mention that the Kesef HaKadshim that you do not have in your source sheets makes it clear that when it's extremely unlikely that an adversary will refuse to come to Beit Din, one may go directly to court. And there's an assumption... Sorry, what did I say? When it is extremely likely that an adversary will refuse to go to Beit Din, one may go directly to court. There's an assumption that non-Jews will not come to Beit Din. That follows from the insurance company exemption. But the Beit Din of America does not extend that assumption to non-observant Jews off the bat and does not differentiate between observant and non-observant Jews. And we send hasmanas in all cases unless the summoned party makes it clear that they will not appear in Beit Din. And actually, recently, we did have a case involving a cemetery. It was non-observant parties that owned the cemetery association. An older woman contacted us because her son died years ago, and she paid for perpetual care. But whenever she visits the cemetery, it looks overgrown and clearly unattended to. She wanted us to send Hasmana to the cemetery. We did, but the cemetery made it very clear that they had no interest in coming to Beit Din, and we issued a heter kaz, and she had to proceed in court. We also have to, this becomes a little trickier, number three. We have to figure out a lot of times who the proper parties to the action are, who should be the parties in the case. often, especially because we're dealing with potentially unsophisticated or unrepresented parties, the tovea, or the plaintiff in the action, will fill out its interior application online and summon the defendant always in their individual capacity. And often the parties can't agree who the named party should be in an arbitration agreement. I included for you on page 25 in the packet a sample arbitration agreement that the Bates of America uses. This is basically our standard arbitration agreement, but I added for you paragraphs H and I, which now we're going to be looking at paragraph I, is basically a creative way that we've approached this and addressed the issue in a number of cases. And basically, what the clause allows for is that the matter, the threshold issue of who should be the party in the case, the individual or the corporate entity, is something that would be adjudicated by the panel of Dayanim as a threshold issue before the substantive case would even get started. And we have found that this has actually gone over really well with parties in a case. And just to highlight some of the language for you, the principal, once the dayanim decide whether or not the defendant in his personal capacity should be listed, the principal shall have the option of entering into an arbitration agreement with plaintiff that provides for him to join as a party to this arbitration. If he declines such option, then the Beit Din, in its sole discretion, may dismiss the case in its entirety without prejudice and grant plaintiff leave to pursue its claims against defendant and principal in secular courts. And in such an event, the principal acknowledges that the hazmana process against him may be initiated and a seirav may be issued pursuant to our rules and procedures. So instead of going back and forth and arguing about appearing personally or on behalf of the entity, this officially gets the parties to sign the arbitration agreement and gets them in the door. Similarly, when a party argues that a necessary third party needs to join the action and that he'll only come to Beit Din if the third party comes, we would insert paragraph H, which also has creatively and efficiently handled this issue. We recently had a case in Beit Din where a contractor was sued in court by a client, a homeowner, and the contractor wanted the case transferred to Beit Din. The client refused on the grounds that the subcontractor was a necessary party and insisted that because the subcontractor was a non-Jew, he would refuse to come to Beit Din. In fact, the subcontractor agreed to come to Beit Din, and we continued the hazmana process against the homeowner. And unfortunately, he has yet to agree to come to Beit Din. Okay. Some of the issues that occur after signing an arbitration agreement. Once we have a case appropriate for Beit Din and the appropriate parties have signed an arbitration agreement, our office will schedule a Din Torah hearing in the matter. And typically, the parties do come. Sometimes, even after signing an arbitration agreement, a party will refuse to appear. And in that instance, the plaintiff can go to court to make a motion to compel arbitration. And according to the rules and procedures of the Beit Din of America that you have in front of you, the Beit Din would hold a default hearing. We are careful to follow the procedural rules so that there's a careful paper trail for the plaintiff in this matter. If you see on page 21 of the sources, the CPLR just mandates that there be 8 days notice. There's an 8-day notice requirement according to the CPLR, and we'll make sure to send a confirmation hearing letter with 8 days notice. And only after that will we hold a hearing after the 8 days. When I began working at the Beit Din, I inherited along with my desk a letter from a defendant where he stated that he already signed an arbitration agreement, but he changed his mind and refused to come to the hearing. Eventually, we were able to get him to agree to come, and there were actually quite a few hearings held in that case. After the Beit Din holds a default hearing, according to Section 17 of our rules, the Beit Din is allowed to issue a decision on the merits after hearing from one side. Okay, I'm sorry for the press for time. Just the post-arbitration hearing, some issues that possibly could come up. Rabbi Weissman mentioned earlier that we have an appeal process. Some arbitration bodies, like the American Arbitration Association, have limited appeal procedures. In fact, according to the AAA's rules, the AAA can only handle an appeal of an arbitration award if the parties have agreed between themselves that an appeal is allowed. Unique to the Beit Din of America is an appeal process built into our rules and procedures, and any losing party can appeal. Naturally, any losing party wants to appeal, but the Beit Din's rules and procedures limit a request for modification of award to the five categories listed in Section 31 of our rules and procedures that you do also have in front of you. The first few categories, as Rabbi Weissman explained, have to do with the technical defects in the psak, like the miscalculation of an award. The last is more broad, like making a mistake of Jewish law. There are times when the appeal dayan remands the case back to the original panel of dayanim. We had a case where, upon request, a reward was modified upon remand by $4.1 million because the dayanim hadn't taken into account one line item. We had another case where a landlord-tenant case where a psak was changed by $437 because the dayan overlooked a receipt. And that also shows you the vastly different kinds of cases we handle at the Beit Din. There was even an instance where the appeal dayan, and I believe it was Rabbi Weiss, who often and regularly serves as an appeal dayan, remanded a case because he thought the original psak lacked sufficient reasoning. As an aside, according to the CPLR, arbitrators are not necessarily obligated to provide reasoned decisions, but at the Beit Din of America, we always do, and we hold ourselves to Rabbi Weiss's standard of sufficient reasoning. There are some times when parties do encounter post-order collection issues. The Beit Din does not have enforcement powers. We cannot garnish wages. We cannot place liens on property. We cannot attach a bank account. But the Beit Din's psak can be confirmed and enforced in a court of American jurisdiction. The winning party must petition the court to confirm the award. In New York, a party has only 1 year to confirm an award. It varies in other states. It's definitely important to be aware of these deadlines. Upon motion, the court must confirm the award unless there exists some reason to vacate. And I printed for you here in the CPLR the list of the grounds for vacating. They're under very limited circumstances that generally fall under something like corruption or fraud, misconduct in procuring the award. The court is not allowed to revisit the merits of the underlying dispute when considering whether or not to confirm an award. Before I close, lastly, I wanted to make sure to bring your attention to a case that you have in the packet. Lang v. Levy is actually a decision written by the Court of Special Appeals in Maryland, where the Court of Appeals affirmed the Beit Din of America's reversal of the Beit Din's original arbitration award by way of Rabbi Willig's appeal psak. So Rabbi Willig wrote an appeal psak that reversed the original Beit Din's panel award, and the Special Court of Appeals in Maryland upheld this reversal. I know I was a little bit rushed. I hope I was able to give you a sense of the procedural issues that arise in the Beit Din of America. And please use my contact information and reach out to me with any further questions or any time you encounter a client that we possibly could help.